You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Well, hello and welcome to TFM's local watering hole. I am so excited to be here today. We have got a fantastic movie to talk about. It is truly out of this world. And with me here to talk about Project Hail Mary, go long, Rye.
Hello, what's up? Thanks for having me back. As always, I am so pumped to talk about Project Hail Mary. I've been looking forward to this movie for a long time, and I can't wait. There's so much to talk about.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm right there with you. This is one of those I was very much looking forward to. We'll dive into all of that. Before we do, of course, just make sure you're subscribed to the podcast wherever you're listening. And then, you know, star ratings and reviews, really popular and helpful for shows to grow. Of course, also word of mouth is also a great way to grow a podcast, whether in person or, of course, on social media, where you can find us on X, Twitter, at the 602 Club. We're on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM. So we'd love it if you'd follow us and interact with us there. You can also find us over on Facebook with the entire network at Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. We've got our new website at tfm.fan. You can see all of the shows we're doing. We love the new website, so I hope you'll check that out. And, of course, you can support us over on Patreon at patreon.com/TrekFM and make sure that all the shows and everything that we're trying to do can keep happening. So, Rye, you mentioned that you, and I said the same thing, really excited for this film. And so, As we look at this, this is obviously from Andy Weir. He wrote The Martian and, of course, the book Artemis and Project Hail Mary. Mm-hmm. So was this one of those where you had also read the book, you know, as we come from page to screen? Is that what caused the excitement? Or was it just the fact that, you know, you loved The Martian and so you're like, oh, man, this dude's doing another movie. I can't wait to see what happens.
Yeah, there's a number of factors that I think went into my excitement. I have not read the book. I had been told by people that read fiction more often than I do that, like, the book's amazing. You should really check it out. The audiobook's supposed to be incredible. And so, like, I had thought about reading it beforehand, but I kind of wanted to take in the story at first by watching it. And so my excitement came from people's word of mouth being like, the book's really amazing. Then you have Lord and Miller, who have done the Jump Street movies, which are fun. And then they're obviously, they did the Lego movie. And then they've famously been highly, highly involved with the production of the Spider-Verse movies, which are obviously, at least in my opinion, like incredible, incredible movies. And so that was a part of it. I love sci-fi. I love space movies. And then Ryan Gosling is like one of my favorite actors. And so it was like all this mixed together. I was like, this is going to be awesome. And then you get like some more the behind the scenes guys with the cinematographer and composer, which we'll talk later. But it's like all that together. I was like, I'm pumped for this movie.
Yeah, so I'd read The Martian before it came mm-hmm. out, and then of course saw the movie and really enjoyed it. Thought it was mm-hmm. really movie. Well done, mm-hmm. great adaptation too of the book. I thought, you know, that's also one of the keys to that. I felt like, you know, with the adaptation, they were able to bring everything you loved about the book into the film and do it in a way that, you know, brought all that energy from the book. You know, the way in which he writes specifically is snappy, and mm-hmm. you know, he's using all this science and everything, but at the same time he's able to really keep you invested, which is yeah. You know, an incredible thing to be able to do, because as much as possible, especially with The Martian, all the science is real, you know? I mean, right. And so when you're reading that, to make that interesting to people who are not science people, you have to do that with a lot of finesse. And I think he's able to do that. And of course, I read Artemis. That's not actually my favorite book of his. I did not really enjoy that one as much. But then when Project Hail Mary came out, because I didn't really like Artemis, I actually skipped the book for a long time.
Okay.
And with the movie coming out, I was like, okay, I'm going to read this book. And I read the book, and it was fantastic. I thought it was so well done, really inventive, and I really, really enjoyed it. And so I was even more excited for the movie, you know. Mm-hmm. And like you, knowing that Lord and Miller were behind this, I've loved a lot of what they've done, you know. Regardless of what happened behind the scenes with Solo, I don't really put that on them. I think that was much more, you know, an issue that they ended up having with the higher-ups, specifically Kathy Kennedy.
This makes me wonder what Solo would have been if they stayed on it. That's what, like, watching this movie, I'm like, oh, so they can make a pretty good space movie.
Yeah, but, you know, I think for that and for that project specifically, you know, they probably were injecting a lot more humor into it than, you know, those at mm-hmm. Lucasfilm were kind of ready for, with totally. Too much improvisation and all that kind of, anyway, regardless, that's not what we're talking about. So coming into this, you know, I'm absolutely like you. I'm excited. I think mm-hmm. Ryan Gosling's fantastic. You know, I think he does the way in which, you know, he is just kind of able to capture you on screen mm-hmm. in the sense of, like, you couldn't be more excited to be watching him on screen mm-hmm. Is awesome. Yeah. And, you know, he's just got a magnetic personality. And so coming into this, I was really looking forward to it. And I think, you know, I knew it was coming because I'd read the book, but I think one of the things that's really interesting about this film is that it is the end of the world. It's one mm-hmm. of those stories, right? And yet, what I was fascinated by was that this isn't an end-of-the-world story where humans are causing the end of the world, mm-hmm. right? This is about this idea of an invasive species coming from another part of the galaxy and feeding on our sun and making it slowly go dark, in much the same way as, like, you know, this happens in the United States, right? You have an invasive water species that gets introduced from another part of the country where mm-hmm. it has natural predators that keep it at bay, but it gets to another part of the country and they just end up taking over lakes. Or, you know, the mm-hmm. same thing has happened with, like, certain types of ivy and things like that. I mean, if you go to Atlanta, there is in Georgia a certain type of ivy that got released into the wild there that grows on all these trees and starts to kill the trees because it suffocates them, kind right. of thing. So this is something that we naturally see in our world where certain types of plants or animals or whatever were made for a specific type of environment. And when they're in the wrong environment, they go crazy. And so I wanted to ask you about that because I feel like that is a really interesting way for humanity to basically have to deal with the end of the world instead of, like, oh, it's just our fault, we're the worst, whatever. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it is interesting. It most movies like this where it's the end of the world, like, you even think of, like, a movie that's being compared to, like Interstellar. Like, that movie is like, it's our fault, we've ruined the planet, now we got to go save it. Versus this, it's really, yeah, it's like a nice change of pace, I think, for me, where it's, they're not like, oh no, we suck, we screwed up again. But it's like, no, there's actually this thing that is happening that is completely outside of our control. There's nothing that we've done to cause this. And now we do need to go save the world. How are we going to do that? And, like, how do we do this together? Like, how do we get the countries to work together in this? Versus, like, this blame game of, like, you did this, you did this. It just makes for it's still a heavy topic, but, like, a lighter start to it, if that makes sense. which, yeah, I think just plays really well in a movie scene where most of the time world-saving events are happening because humans suck, which can get a little either boring or just like, okay, we get it. We do things that hurt our world. So it's a nice change of pace for me.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that aspect of the film too, because for anybody who's read the book, there is a lot more to it in the ways in which, you know, they are given all this power, right? You know, to be able to do whatever they want, basically, to save the world. Eva is given carte blanche, literally, for anything and everything she needs. As the head of this project. And I wanted to ask you about that because in the movie, did it feel like to you that was accentuated enough to kind of get the understanding of exactly what they're doing and how expansive that is?
I think so. I've seen the movie twice now. I saw it on the like opening day last Thursday, and then I saw it on Tuesday again. And in between those times, I heard some more of like details from the book, which made it interesting. Like the amount of weight that's put on Eva's shoulders to like make these decisions that she's bearing, the like completely bearing the weight of like sending these people to go kill themselves essentially in space, and decisions being made. And so like the first time around, like I felt it, and I was like, this is heavy, this is, but knowing the context, even like I think they do a really good job, but it's much more subdued than it sounds like the book is. It's still, I still felt it. I still felt like Sandra Hüller's character was dealing with a heavy burden, but once I knew the context, I felt like it was shown even more. Like it kind of opened up my eyes to like the subtleties of what she's doing with the performance and like her character. So I think it's like if you know the context and you go into it, you're gonna see that more. But I think either way, I think people still felt it. I think like everyone I talked to was like, man, she has a, you know, tough job making every decision, you know. So,
Yeah. You know, I think that it was really interesting for me having read the book because, you know, part of the things that happen in the book are she and this team are not only having to make decisions about Project Hail Mary, but they're also having to make decisions about you know, how do they alleviate some of the problems this is already causing on Earth, you know. So there's a whole place where they have to blow up bombs, atomic bombs, basically in the Arctic and or in Antarctica, so that they can melt polar ice and release CO2 into the air, you know, to warm the planet. You know, there's a whole aspect of like to grow the amount of astrophage that they need, which is the molecule that is slowly eating away our sun, but is also going to turn into the power source to get us where we need to go. They have to basically pave a bunch of the Sahara Desert. And so there's all of this stuff that it was interesting that it felt like they could have in the movie. I love the movie. I think it's great, but I think that there are some places where they could have touched on some of those things to show the dire necessity for this. I think that there were some places where the movie just didn't go far enough to show us just how bad this is going to be on Earth. Like, and even that the decisions that are having to be made at this moment and that she's having to make as the head of this project and that humanity is having to, I mean, like, we come together or we die kind of thing. You know, I would have liked to seen that a little bit more because I think that that's a real interesting part of the book. In some ways, you know, this is a interesting variation on the Star Trek idea of First Contact, right? Mm-hmm. That First Contact with the Vulcans after World War III is kind of what brings humanity together, realizing they're not alone. Mm-hmm. This, in some ways, is that same type of story. We realize, one, we're not alone in the galaxy, and we have to come together, otherwise we're all going to die,
right,
kind of thing. And so I just wish the movie had had a little bit more of that. But I think that, for the most part, the adaptation is really good, and they do a decent job of really bringing to life, you know, the difficulty,
mm-hmm,
in all of this and the decision making, and so, yeah.
Yeah, I wonder what, like, I think I agree, knowing that that's what was in the book, it's like, yeah, it would have been nice, like, even like a kind of a montage-esque, like, like, here's the things that we're doing to try to save the world while they're in space, like, on this journey. It doesn't necessarily, I mean, it doesn't play to Lord and Miller's style as much as to be that, like, dark and heavy, I guess. There's some stuff in this that still is, but I wonder if that's why they didn't do it, or if it was just cut, which is an entirely possibility, because I saw an article that came out saying that their, like, first run of the movie was 3 hours and 50 minutes or something like that, and then the note was like, make it shorter. And so I wonder if they did have stuff that was filmed and they're like, oh, we'll just take it away. I don't know. I think it would add to it as well. I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes sense that the movie was that much longer, because I'm guessing what they also had done is that they had filmed a lot more of the stuff that's in the book, where, because there's a lot more things that kind of go wrong throughout, mm-hmm, the story that are not in the film. And,
yeah,
you know, again, any adaptation, it makes sense that you're going to have to cut things out, and you've got to be able to make the point with the time that you have, and you can't keep people into the theaters. You know, I mean, I don't think that this movie needs to be 3 hours. It's not one of those type of movies, mm-hmm, you know. Totally. I don't think it's benefited by being 3 hours. And so I think they made the right choices in that sense. You know, to add a minute's worth, like you said, of like a montage of in those scenes where they're kind of showing all of the scientists coming together and all this stuff, and some of those decision-making aspects of what the Earth, you know, what those on Earth are having to do before they launch this project to actually make it even happen would have been, I think, really interesting for the film. And, you know, who knows? I mean, maybe there's a director's cut. You know, there was an extended, right, cut of The Martian, so, and people, mm-hmm, really seem to have loved what they added there. So maybe that happens with Project Hail Mary. But
yeah, there was a moment, I don't know if we're going to talk about it, so I just want to mention it, that is added. I know it's not in the book, that I did actually feel the weight of, and some people don't like the scene, so I'd be curious if you like it or not. But it's the moment where Sandra Hüller sings the karaoke song. And although, yeah, we're not seeing these things happen, when she sang The Sign of the Times, I actually felt heavier. Like, I felt like there was this actual, like, oh, this is, like, really serious, and this is really sad. And maybe that was their way of trying to communicate how heavy this was. But, yeah, I just like that scene.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things in that, you know, when we're thinking about the end of the world, I felt like that scene was one of those things that accentuated what they're going through,
mm-hmm,
you know, and part of that, I think it was more that solidified the relationship between Eva and,
yeah,
but, you know, between Grace, mm-hmm, you know, like Ryland and Eva have this really tight relationship. It's a very difficult relationship in some ways, but they also, there's something between them, right? And I think that at that moment, her singing that song is almost her way of saying, hey, in her brain, like, if I have to send him off on this mission, there's, right, a possibility of that ever like, I need to do this in some ways for him. Mm-hmm. And it's like, we might all die, so why not live life a little bit? So right. I thought the scene, yeah, worked in that sense, mm-hmm. especially when we're discussing, you know, yeah, it's the end of the world. So yeah,
totally. Totally.
With we mentioned at the top, you know, Ryan Gosling and like The Martian, this movie is really driven by him. He has to create a performance that's going to keep you in the film at every moment, because it's almost always just him on screen,
mm-hmm.
For most of the film, playing off a puppet, you know, yeah, kind right. of like Luke Skywalker in Dagobah, you know. And so we'd love to hear your thoughts about his performance, what you think he's able to do well, what is it, you know, just about what he's able to bring to this role that, you know, others couldn't do.
Yeah, I mean, he is, I think he's pretty remarkable in this. Like you said, I mean, he's carrying the movie. There is the puppet Rocky, and we have Sandra Hüller and a couple other people on Earth that are, you know, fine and good. But he carries the movie. It's on his shoulders completely, and he's tasked with doing a lot. Because one, he's like, he is genuinely so funny. He's such a funny comedic actor. His timing is perfect. Just the way he's delivering lines, like his, like even like the physicality he has in certain moments, in the ship, it's like so perfect. I'm like, oh my goodness, he is like truly one of our great actors right now. And also he does deliver, like, there's like very, like one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie is like him saying goodbye to the people that had died, just like at, right near the beginning. And like, he's having to like be very, like he's very sad. Like, it's an emotional thing. And he's doing that. And then he's going all the way to this like crazy comedic, like silly, performance. And so being able to do all those things, 95% of the screen time is on you, and you're then acting alongside a puppet. Like, that's pretty awesome. It's one of my favorite performances he's ever given. And I've seen 21 Ryan Gosling movies. So like, I think he's doing great stuff. Like, it's not a surprise, but I absolutely loved him. What'd you think?
I mean, it's so funny because I think one of the things that makes this really difficult is that Ryan Gosling is just so good at what he does. So it's hard to feel like there's anything valid to say because it's already all been said about yeah. what he's able to do in yeah. the films that he's in, you mm-hmm. know? And I think that, you know, honestly, it's one of those things where he is a driver behind this film, and there was never anybody else who was going to play this role. It was always going to be him. Mm-hmm. Everybody behind the film wanted him to be a part of it, right? They wanted yeah. him to play this role. And you know, I think this is something that's incredibly interesting about him, is that I can buy him as a romantic leading man who is like the ultra man's man type of guy, in the sense of like what we see in Crazy Stupid Love, right? Where, you know, he is just, he's the most suave, you know, and somewhat swarmy kind of like dude ever. And then I can watch him in this type of film where he's playing a high school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And you buy it because he has the ability to craft his personality in such a way as that it feels right.
Mm-hmm.
That's really impressive, because those are two completely different types of roles, and yet he's bringing a lot of the same energies, but just from a different perspective that allows you to buy that. I think there's something really interesting here, because the beauty of this as well is that he's also not playing this as the hero.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't want to go on this mission. He's willing to let the entire Earth die
yeah.
if need be, for him not to go on this mission. He is not a hero in this film until he's stuck in space and there's nothing else he can do.
Right.
Right? I mean, and I think that that's also an interesting thing to have to play, where you fall in love with this character, but then you get to this moment, especially if you've never read the book, and you realize, oh, he didn't even want to be here. Like, he is not a good dude in the end, right? And so he's a character who has to be able to grow into almost like this. And I, what's interesting about it is I don't even know if we could call it like quite a redemption arc, because he doesn't just, he literally has zero choice, right? It's like, I do this or I die. Right. Yeah. And so, and you know, I just find that the fact that Ryan Gosling can bring that to life and still make us root for the character is something incredibly special about him as an actor, because not everybody can pull that off.
Yeah, no, he's quite literally the perfect person for the role. Not very many people can be as funny as he is, and as like charming as he is, and also as serious. And like you said, his range is kind of like up there with the greats, especially in the last 25 years. Like, you look at his filmography, and like you said, he's like got Crazy Stupid Love and La La Land, like romance movies. Then he has his like comedy stuff he's doing with this, and The Nice Guys, Barbie, The Fall Guy, and then he has like these serious sad roles that, like, it's just wild to me that he's able to do so much, and yeah, make you root for him when you learn this guy kind of sucks. He's selfish, self-absorbed, doesn't care about anybody but himself until obviously the end of the movie. There's somewhat of an arc, but like, yeah, like you said, he doesn't. He doesn't have a choice. He kind of just is doing it because he's the only one there, and he'd be a really awful person if he didn't. So.
Well, and I want to ask you about that, because with talking about Ryan Gosling and having to play that, how do you feel like the movie then does with that element, that kind of thematic element then of being willing to do what it takes then, you know, to save the world? Regardless the cost, does it help you see him make that turn well enough, or do you feel like that might be a place where there possibly needed to be, you know, less humor and just a little bit more introspection for the character, or something that allows that theme to be more to the forefront? Or do you think they handle it well?
I think the answer is like both. If there's, and all of this is given, like, I haven't read the book, but I know that a lot of the book is driven by Grace's inner dialogue. And I've heard some clips where he's talking horrible about himself. He's like, I didn't want to go. I'm this awful person, essentially. And we don't get any of that. And it's obviously, like, even when he's leaving, or when Sandra Hüller is not, they're tackling him to put him under, to send him up. It's, you can tell that he really doesn't want to go. So, like, I think it communicates, like, that he is in some part selfish, that he's unwilling to go do this no matter what. I think it's communicated very well, but it also is still played off as comedic. He's doing his, like, scream. He's, you know, jumping on the shelves, and he's running away. He's, like, talking to Carl. He's like, Carl, you know, it's, like, it's funny. So it's, like, both. It's, like, I did feel it. I did feel like he was this guy that's, like, oh, dang, I've really been liking him. And now I'm like, oh, geez, there's something completely different about him now, like, given the context. But also, it was, like, funny and, like, played off like that. And so I think it could have been played better, but I also didn't mind it. I think it did what it was supposed to, but could have been better, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I really agree with that, because there's also, I feel like, the moment where he wakes up and it feels like you know, there is a lot of just woe is me. I'm stuck here. I don't really even know where I am. And I think that that's one of the things that that's changed from the book to the movie is that in the book, it takes him much longer to remember who he even is. And so I think almost that process of him remembering these things in the book, it because it's a slower span of time for him to even remember his name, you know, and, you know, he becomes one of those characters in the book who's like, I can do these things and I know these things, but I don't quite know exactly all this, you know, why. Until it also begins to click. And so, yeah, I would have liked to have seen a section of the movie kind of deal with the idea of being willing to become a person who's, you know, willing to sacrifice themselves. And I think, you know, a part of that thematic element for the character of Grace comes down to, you know, his meeting Rocky. And the moment that he realizes, I think, that it's not just Earth that's in trouble, but it's, you know, this other planet that's in trouble, and that they then are the only two people. They're already here. So we've got to do whatever it takes to save our planet, you know. I think there's a there's an aspect where that is the thing that kind of helps him change his behavior and his thought process. And, you know, maybe it's just and I think this is one of the things about the film is it's just kind of a subtle change for the character. I think it'll be interesting. I've only gotten a chance to see it once, so I'd be excited to see it again to see how that part kind of plays out more so, you know, with that character's arc. And if I'm able to just kind of pick up more things on that because, you know, I think it is an important part of the story.
Yeah, I will say on second watch, everything played better. Every gripe I had the first time, and I loved, I mean, I loved it the first time I watched it, but every gripe I had, everything felt smoother. Everything felt like I could see more of what they were going for and different things like that. So it definitely helped watching a second time.
Yeah. What did you think, you know, we talked, we've talked about Sandra Hüller's Eva and respect to her relationship with Ryan Gosling and the character of Grace, but what did you think of just the way in which she brings that character to life and somebody who basically, for all intents and purposes, has become Atlas?
Yeah.
You know, she's become Atlas. The weight of the world is legit on her shoulders, and if she doesn't make this happen, no one will, and they all die. And so how did she do?
I think she's great. I think she's a great actress. I've only seen her in one, maybe two other things. And so this is like a new actress for me. Like seeing, like what I've seen her previously, I was like, she's really good. And so I was like pretty confident she'd be good in this. And she, I think she was very good. I think, like I said, that scene helps a lot. You can just tell by her demeanor, the way she's playing the character, is that she seems very like almost distraught by like, you know, everything. Like there's exciting things happening technically by like what they're learning and the astrophage and like Ryan, like she's the complete opposite to Ryan Gosling's Grace, where he's still very spunky and full of life and he's, you know, crazy and silly. And she's so mellow, so subdued because she does have that weight of like every decision I make is going to quite literally affect all of humanity, and that's a lot for a person to deal with. And I think she does a really good job portraying it. Even if we could have seen a little bit more, I think what we got was still very good from her.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree with you more. I thought that in many ways, when it comes to the character from the book, I thought she might be the actual best portrayal of what, you know, you get there just because, and again, I'm not taking anything away from Ryan Gosling, partly just because they kind of shift and, you know, change some of the things about the character and what he goes through. But, and not to a huge extent, but just a little bit, but like her, I mean, again, to play a character where everything is riding on you, all the decisions that you make, everything is riding on you. You are the one who, like, you're literally the person who's making every decision to either die or survive.
Right.
You know, as humanity. And for that to be encapsulated in one person, I thought was incredibly difficult. And even that moment, you know, where she, you know, is telling Grace, you think I'm giving you a choice. I'm not giving you a choice. I'm just telling you what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's an incredibly powerful moment because you can tell that, you know, she's come to care about this person,
mm-hmm.
but she has to do what must be done. You know, in the end, this is like one of those films where, you know, the ends kind of have to justify the means or there are no ends.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And she's trying to do it in a way that is comforting and as loving as possible. At the same time, it's kind of like that tough love thing of like, I'm sorry, buddy, you're the only person. So buck up and do what must be done, you mm-hmm. know. And I think that in that sense, she becomes the person who's willing to lay down everything for the sake of everyone.
Right.
Right. And becomes a better representation of that type of theme in a much more difficult position in the sense that she's sacrificing everything of herself, even somewhat of her own humanity by having to send these people to die and knowing that there's no hope for them
mm-hmm.
to come back. At least that's what we think.
Yeah.
And yet she's going to do it. And the kind of like sacrificial love in that sense is much more difficult on her part because she's the one who's having to be the person to be like, give people the bad news, you know?
Yeah.
Especially with Ryland. And so I thought she was fantastic and I thought she mm-hmm. did just a fantastic job. And honestly, I'm kind of more interested in some ways to see the movie just to pick up on all the little nuances of her portrayal.
It's
because
really,
again, she's not over the top. She's mm-hmm. everything she's doing is just so subtle, but mm-hmm. I was really sucked in by her portrayal.
Yeah. I think the second time you watch it, you'll notice a lot more. I know I noticed a lot more of like, I'm like, wow, she's like actually like capital A acting here. Like it's pretty incredible to watch.
Yeah. 100% agree. James Ortiz, you know, is the voice of Rocky, and you know you have him brought to life by these Rocketeers who are doing the puppetry. Mm-hmm. I mean, Rocky is there's no CGI; mm-hmm. it's a puppet.
Yeah,
it's created by Neil Scanlan's Creature Shop, and so look, I'm sure like anything and everything, I'm sure there is some CGI to some of this.
Yeah, of course.
I don't, you know, but I think. I wanted to ask you how you felt about just everything involved with bringing this character, who is incredibly pivotal to the story, to life. Does it work for you?
I, like, when I say it works, I mean, like, it works to an extent that is, like, unbelievable. Because he looks so real. There's, like... And, like, yeah, sometimes CGI is so good that you can't tell if it's real or not. Like, yeah, I get that. But there's, like, a feeling as you're watching it, knowing that it's a puppet, that there's, like, this feeling like, wow, like, Ryan Gosling is acting against something. There's no tennis ball. There's a puppet and someone right there, or multiple people right there, moving him and reacting with him, and then someone's voice who's reacting and like riffing. They talk about like their the improv moments, where one of them's one of the funniest moments in the movie, where Grace is talking about his ex and now he's with Mark, and it was improvised that James was like, Rocky, hate Mark. Like that was a completely improvised thing. Like Rocky feels so real and feels like a character that you can really fall in love with. It's probably similar to like Yoda, you know, when Yoda, like, it was a puppet. He was real. There was something there to see, to, you know, and it matters. I don't know why. There's something I think in our brains that, like, it's much cooler that there's like an actual physical presence there. And like the artistry behind it's so cool. Like, puppets are awesome. Like, you know, like being skilled in that area, I think is really cool. So, I fell in love with Rocky. Like, I didn't think I'd ever like be so emotional over like a rock alien, but like, here we are, you know? So I think going into the movie, I couldn't have expected it to be as good as it was, because it felt like, man, if they nailed one thing in this movie, which I think they nailed a whole lot of things, but like the thing that felt like quite literally perfect, I have no notes on, is Rocky and their portrayal of him.
Yeah, I think this is one of those places where and I think that it was, and I'm going to give it credit, but I think The Mandalorian is the thing that really set the stage for people to remember that you can, with what they can do these days with puppets, you can make a thing feel incredibly lifelike and real, and you don't have to utilize just CGI. And I'm not knocking the fact that, you know, we went down the CGI road, because I think it's incredibly important. It's just another tool in the toolbox.
Totally.
I think The Mandalorian helped us remember that the puppet toolbox is incredibly valid still. And it works. And the beauty of the puppetry, too, is that, again, right, there's always going to have to be CGI involved, because you're always going to have to clean up little movements here and there. You're always going to have to be, you know, scoping out the puppeteers themselves and the poles that are used and all that stuff. So there's always going to be a melding of the worlds. And so why not have the best of both worlds?
Yeah.
In puppets, something that's, like you said, is literally on screen and therefore allows your actor to be able to act to something. Again, I think that's one of those places where, you know, the beauty of Yoda is that he's literally on screen for Mark Hamill to act to.
Yeah.
And it is Mark Hamill who's making you believe that this character is real. Right? You never think to yourself, oh, this is just a Muppet.
Right.
Right? You always think, no, this is a character, because the way in which the live actor is interacting with this thing, and it just always comes off as real. You know, Ryan Gosling is having to do the same thing. Regardless of how good that puppet is on screen and everything, there's still five people behind him helping with the puppetry, and there's probably the noises of everything like happening, and he's got to tune all that out and pretend like this is still a real thing. I mean, it's like playing with a stuffed animal as a kid, you know. You got to pretend like it's real, and he's doing that. And so I think all of it just comes to life in such a beautiful way, you know, bringing you know, this hamster to life is fantastic. I mean, because legit, he's, you know, got an intergalactic hamster cage, and hamster ball, and it works, you know. And so
it just feels so authentic. Like, I remember I saw an I think it was an interview that James Ortiz did, and they were talking about the thumbs up thing, because which obviously has become like a massive, like, everyone's doing this, like, thumbs down. And when Ryan Gosling did that, when he did like the thumbs up thing, they had Rocky do it, but the way it was built, it was like they only could do a thumbs down. They're like, well, that's all, the only thing we can do. And then, you know, they react based on it. Like, things like that just make it feel so authentic and so lived in. And yeah, I think it's so awesome.
Yeah. Well, and I wanted to, before we kind of got into anything else, this was something that that you had mentioned, and I thought this was a really important part of the film too. The discussion between Grace and Eva about God was really interesting in the movie.
Yeah,
because Eva says, God willing. And Grace mm-hmm. says, you believe in God? And she's like, well, it's better than the alternative.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's not anything more to that. But I thought that that was really interesting, specifically, you know, in this ecosphere of Andy Weir's books where everything is just about science. Mm-hmm. But this idea of that even somebody like Eva, who knows everything, right? She knows all the science and all this stuff, but in the end, she's realizing that, wow, we have like a 1 in a million shot of this working, if mm-hmm. not, you know, even more in the statistical realm. And so I've got to believe that hopefully there's something bigger and better out there than just us trying to make mm-hmm. us survive. And I wanted to ask you about that because it is this really small moment in the film. And yet, at the same time, I found it incredibly powerful as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think it was, I mean, it's like literally 10 seconds of the movie, maybe, like if we're being generous. Like, it's not a long, like they're talking. She says, God willing. He says, you believe in God? And she says, better than the alternative. And then they look at each other, and then that's that. Like, that's it. And it's just like a fascinating, like you said, like with how scientific Andy Weir writes, and like with The Martian, and with this, like there's a lot of science going on. Some of this science is obviously not
it's like made up.
It's made up science, yeah. But there's still like scientific talk, and they're using like real science for some of these things. And it just felt like this incredibly sincere, like, truthful moment to be like, man, we're doing all this stuff. We have all these equations. We have the rocket ship. We have this made up, you know, new fuel that we're using. Like, this is a long shot, obviously, the Hail Mary. But, man, I choose to believe in something that is bigger, that is more powerful, that is in control. Because if there's not, then man, what the heck are we doing here? Like then there's like no hope. It's like this moment of like, I still have hope because I think that there's something better, to believe in than just nothing. And so I just appreciated it. I know a lot of people that I've, you know, talked to about the movie, they're like, they always point out that scene. I mean, like I said, it's like 10 seconds long. So it's scenes like that in movies that make movies even better than, you know, like if it wasn't in the movie, would we be, you know, it'd be still a great movie, but it just like adds a little bit more to the movie, which I love.
Yeah, I think what it does is that it accentuates for this film the impossibility of what they're about to try to accomplish.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that for there to really be any hope, there is so little hope in any of this going right.
Mm-hmm.
That there's got to be something, we need something to be behind this for that to happen. And right. Because in all honesty, you know, as you read the book and then you watch the film, there are so many things that actually do go right in this that you're like, okay, there's no way there isn't some providence behind this. You know, just even the fact that the two ships are able to find one another in space
mm-hmm.
is just crazy. It's crazy. That alone is astronomical, just because of the vastness of space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to ask you a little bit about the production value, because obviously Greg Fraser is our DP here. They've made a lot of stink, I would say, about the idea that they did not use any green screen.
Yeah,
but of course that doesn't mean there isn't CGI in the film. And so, how did you feel like all of this works to bring this to life? Because we've seen, I think, some incredible movies dealing with space, you know, in the last 10, 15 years. I mean, mm-hmm. I think Interstellar is probably still the high watermark for what, you know, space shots look like these days. And so how did they pull this off?
Yeah, incredibly well. The ship stuff, like the production, like they built all these sets. They, you know, they built the floors 5 feet off the ground so that the puppets could use Rocky. Like, it's so, it feels very lived in. It doesn't feel like there's like a set and a green wall and, you know, there's no blue screen. It's like they're moving around in this built spaceship, which helps. And then the space shots in, I mean, this movie looks incredible. The
Petrov line.
Yeah. The Petrov line. I can like, what is it called? That scene where everything goes red, where Grace is out of the ship, the fishing scene with the planet. Like, I mean, this movie just looks amazing. The way that they move the ships through space felt like actually different than I've seen ships move through space, which was really, really cool. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this movie looked amazing. Greg Fraser is obviously one of the best working DPs in movies right now. So getting him to do that with what they put into making things real and not just doing green screen, it made the movie feel more lived in. It made the movie feel more real, and it was great.
Yeah. I mean, I think for the most part, every single thing about this film looks fantastic.
Yeah.
If there's one thing that I might have added, it would have been just some shots to show how small things are in the reference of like space.
Yeah.
I feel like that's one of the things that I really do appreciate about Interstellar is the way in which it pulls back and it shows you just how tiny we are. You know, I think they did that in The Martian actually really well too, when you just have that moment where he's like, you know, spinning in the capsule and you get this sense of just like how tiny he is compared to the planet and everything else. And, and just the, when you're talking about the spaces between things. And so that's probably, and it's just kind of like a minor nitpick complaint. I think it just could have been something that I would have expected to see. But look, I think the way in which they bring this together and the way in which everything works and looks, it's a fantastic film. You know, I think the beauty of this is that I never am pulled out to think to myself, wow, this doesn't feel like real. Like, this doesn't feel like it works. This doesn't, I mean, it all works. It never feels like I'm pulled out of the movie because of the way something looks, which is what you want. You just want consistency. And I think everything is very, very consistent in its look here, so that in doing so, my brain is always locked in to the scenes, you know. And I think that's the thing that makes this work is and it's so important. Look, any film, and I've said this many times on this show, my friend John and I have talked about this many times on the show, but and with CGI work and just with effects work, you just need consistency across the board. So there isn't that moment where your brain is pulled out because it's like, oh, that's not as well done as that. So it's like, I would actually rather have, you know, medium to good level CGI that's all consistent than a moment where one looks astounding and the other looks shoddy. That kills a film, and this is this doesn't struggle with that. And of course, you know, Greg Fraser, again, one of the best DPs out there I mean, he truly is phenomenal. You know, there are guys out there that when I know that they are doing a movie, when they're shooting a film, I'm like, oh, I can't wait to see just what that looks like, which is interesting to be as excited about a DP as you would be like a director, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of so, crazy. You got to be really good at your job.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm thinking like there are names that come to mind, like Roger Deakins. I also enjoy Larry Fong's work, you know. So there are guys out there where, yeah, that I can picture their movies in my head. And it's not about the director. It's not even about the actor. It's just about the way it looks. And he's mm-hmm. one of those guys. And it works great here. So part of that, too, I think, for this film is that the post-production stuff behind the scenes, I think, you know, Daniel Pemberton's score here is also a highlight of the film mm-hmm. Because it's so good. It's so memorable. It's so and it's such a joy to even just listen to outside of the film, which, you know, to me is like, you know, sometimes a movie has a score to which works for the film but doesn't really work outside the film. But this is not one of those scores. This works, I feel like, on every single level.
Yeah, totally. It's so good. Daniel Pemberton's obviously another guy that's becoming more and more popular. Famously did the Spider-Verse score, which is really good. But yeah, I think it's a really interesting score because it does have really quiet moments. There's a lot of quiet moments. Like I said, the scene where Grace is, you know, saying goodbye to his, you know, crew. But then there's also like the fishing scene, which is like a, you know, I'm not going to say it's like directly or as good as like, let's say, the Interstellar docking scene, but like paired with what Daniel Pemberton is doing with that score specifically, I'm like it's like the meme where like the person sits up, like that's what I'm doing. Like I'm sitting up in my seat staring, I'm locked in. And I really appreciate a score that's very I can't think of the right word, but it's doing a lot of things. It's not just very one note throughout the entire movie. And he pairs everything so well, scene to scene. And like you said, I've been listening to it as well. It's very good to listen to outside of the movie.
I think the beauty of it is that he's found a way to kind of marry well a score that has good themes, but mm-hmm. also has, you know, good movement and like rhythm and all of that, you know, within like the Zimmer type of thing. So it's like he's done a good job here of marrying styles that can be difficult to do. Like, you know, you think of trying to bring Williams and Zimmer together, and that I feel like he did a great job in that for this movie. And I really appreciated that. So the movie's ending mm-hmm. is slightly different than the book in the sense that in the book, we never actually have you flash back to Earth with Ava.
Yeah.
And you only get told by the Iridians and by Rocky telling him, hey, Earth's sun is back to normal. So apparently you guys were successful. And so I just wanted to ask you about just the way in which the movie ends here. Does it work for you? Do you like the way it ends? Did you feel like that by them even just flashing back to Earth was necessary to bring home the idea that yes, Earth's not dead, Earth's fine. It's got a long road, but it's going to be okay.
Yeah, I like the ending of the movie. I think it's very good with what they do with Grace, with the where he lives, the biodome with the Iridians. I think is really good. And then flashing to Earth, I don't think that I needed it on a personal level, but I think in general moviegoers want something like that. Especially for this being a movie that like everybody's going to go see. And so I think it's like fine. Like it doesn't like add to the movie, nor does it detract from the movie for me. It's like, I appreciate this. There's like a funny moment. They sent, you know, Grace sends the little thing that Rocky made. And it's like, yeah, it communicates that everything's going to be okay. Let's get to work. Let's do this thing. But I don't think it was like needed per se. But I think the movie ends very well. I love the ending with Grace's character. Yeah, that's kind of it in it. I remember the first time, I will say, a gripe that I had at first that I no longer have is it felt like there was a few different endings. I felt like we were coming to a close, and I was like, oh, where there's more. Oh, there's more. The second time watching it, I didn't feel that, like, literally at all, knowing what was coming. But I think overall, I enjoy the ending. I like where they go with each character. It's a fun, like, satisfying, hopeful ending.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's well done. I think that for the movie, it works better to flashback, because it's a visual medium, right? In a book, I think it makes more sense because the story is really all told from his perspective. And the movie is that way in many senses, but I think it's okay to flashback and especially when, you have this connection with the character of Ava, and so we get to see her be there and to see that, the message has reached her and that Earth is going to be okay, and so I thought that that was worth it. And then, the fact that in the end we see, because one of the things that's not really brought out as well in the movie, I don't think, as it is in the book, which is the Iridians don't have the same level of science that we do. They've sent off Rocky and everybody that was with him in this ship without understanding some things that you would think would be really important to understand. They basically have a Newtonian view of science, instead of an Einstein view of science, and they don't even understand relativity and things like that. So, the fact that Grace then stays on Iridia to educate Iridians, he gets to be a teacher. They create this biodome for him, I think, is a really fascinating thing, and therefore, in some ways, he becomes incredibly important for this whole other species and where their life is going to go next, and also, I think it just leaves us hopeful for this idea that, with astrophage as well, you could have travel between these two planets. Yes, it would take Oh, it takes a while to get there,
long
but
time.
there's still the opportunity for, things to happen. And I also think, we never really discussed this, but the idea of Grace not going home also makes some sense because by the time he got home, most of the people he would have known would probably be almost dead or dead,
Yeah, totally.
Just because of relativity. And so I like that the way just things wrap up. And so I so there's been a lot made about this film, and there's a lot of discussions just on social media about its success and why it's a success and the fact that it has been so successful. It's had, a huge opening here. There this is not, look, other than the fact that this comes from Andy Weir in his book, there's no IP here, right? This is an original sci-fi movie idea. And so why do you think that this movie has really captured the hearts of moviegoers and done so well? What do you think it is about it? What can we learn from this movie's success that would actually be beneficial for Hollywood to actually learn?
I think some of it's Ryan Gosling. Like, he's a movie star. Everyone loves him. He's so charming. Like, it's easy to root for this guy. I think there's that aspect of it. I think it is good, clean family fun. Gosling, very publicly talked about the fact that a lot of his movies his kids can't watch, and so he wanted to make movies more that they could watch, that they could be a part of, that he could take to the premiere and be a whole family thing. And I think people sense that. I think people realize, like, yeah, like I could bring, it's rated PG-13, but man, I could bring my, you know, 10, 11 year old to this movie. That's like what my family, my brother's 11, he's gonna go see this movie. And I think that's a huge aspect of it. And I think people just enjoy, like, it's because of word of mouth, I think, is the other thing. Like, people are going to see this movie because of those reasons just stated. And then they're like, oh, man, this is really good. Like, you know, you tell your friends, you tell your family, like, you should, like, this is, like, everybody's going to love this movie, which is literally what's happening. It's like, I have friends that don't go to the theater very often. They're like, yo, did you see Project Hail Mary? I'm like, yeah, I did. Did you see it? And they're like, yeah, we went and saw it, you know? So it's getting people to go to the theater that it's like, it's, you know, the once to three times a year theater people. Like, that's what the draw is. And I think it's original storytelling. I think it's Gosling. I think it's the family aspect. And I think it is the book a little bit too. It just kind of feels like the perfect, like, blend of all these different things. In terms of what to learn, I do think keep making original stuff, keep putting fun, charming guys in your movies, and, you know, not everything has to be rated R to be funny, I think, as well. This movie's hilarious and there's not a cuss word in it. Like, it's definitely possible.
I agree with that. I think even just starting there, that the fact that the movie, this is good, clean fun for the whole family. And yeah, I think there's some stuff in here that's just, you know, maybe too tense for, you know, a 6-year-old.
Yeah,
but totally. I think, yeah, by the time you get to be 10, I think that, yeah, this is just a great film in that sense. And like you also mentioned, there's no sex, there's no, cursing, right? You know, and part of that is, it, you know, even from the book they pulled that, is he's a character who's a teacher, and so he just says things like gosh darn it and things like that, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's his life. And there is a moment in the book where he does actually curse, and it really means something because of the situation that he's in. And so it's like, I think all of that is really important, so I'm glad you pointed all of that out. I think what this just shows is that people are just starved for good stories.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't really matter what the movie is. People just want good stories. They want to feel as though you've put time and effort into this. I think that's kind of one of the reasons that, like, superhero movies have gone the way of the dodo, it seems like, right now, where it's just there's too much reliance now on these franchises where you come in with a feeling about a film instead of it actually having to prove it to you, you know? Look, you can still make great superhero movies. I think, you know, we had a good example last year of, with the new Superman movie, of it feeling kind of fresh and wonderful to come into something that wasn't just an established universe and all that. I think you can do that. But I think that there is something to just saying, let's make the best possible movie we can and not worry about sequels or prequels or any of that stuff, right? Yeah. You know, I think I'll always go back to this, but one of the reasons that I think that the newer Planet of the Apes films worked was that they were never worried about what they were setting up. They were always just worried about, we are making the best possible movie we can at this moment. We're going to put every single thing into that. If we get a chance to make another film, we'll figure that out when we get there.
Right.
But this is about this movie right now. And those films only got better, in my opinion. You know, I think Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is a different story in the sense that it's not... It does continue the story, but it's set, you know, so far.
Yeah, far in the future.
You know, and it's not about Caesar, right? So it's in its own little world in that sense. But I think we just need to get back to that.
Yeah.
We need to start creating stories, and the beauty of this too is that, like, this is based off of something that is a full-fledged story that, you know, somebody's thought about from start to finish and understands the end. And so you walk into the movie and you walk out of the movie and you've seen an entire story.
Yeah, you're satisfied with the ending. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have to wait till, you know, 2 or 3 years later to see the next installment. You know, I think that there's just something about that. And so, all of these things, I think if Hollywood could just begin to pick up on some of that and say, hey, man, let's just make good movies with good stories that people can walk out of and not have to worry about, like, 3 years down the road, well, maybe I'll know what happens next.
Yeah, totally.
Could be helpful. So, loved talking about this, and I think everybody will not be surprised where we're going to land on our ratings. But, Rye, for you, what are you going to rate Project Hail Mary?
Yeah, I mean, if it isn't obvious, I have a glowing review of this movie. I love it. This movie means a lot to me. I think it's, like, quite perfectly made for me. So I'm giving it a nice, healthy 5 stars.
That's
Where are you landing?
Yeah, I am almost there with you. I think this is one of those things where I might need to see the film again to know if it bumps up all the way to a 5. I think that there's just I don't even know if it's just from reading the book, but I just think it, and maybe it's from that. But this is a 4.5 out of 5 for me right now.
Yeah, great.
I am absolutely open to the fact that this could bump itself up to a 5.
Totally.
Because it just could. And I could, you know, absolutely see seeing this again and being like, it's a 5. But I just think as well, my encouragement, go see this on the biggest and best screen that you can. I went and saw this in Dolby Cinema and it looked beautiful because they did the aspect ratio changes. It was phenomenal. The presentation in something like a Dolby Cinema is gorgeous because, you know, the whole goal of that is excellent projection, you know, to give you the blackest blacks and the brightest colors in ways that you're not getting anywhere else. Do it. Go take your family. Go see this film. Support this movie so that we can get more movies like this in the future. And so, Rye, I know you love talking movies. So if people wanted to catch up with you and talk film with you or see what else is going on in life, where would they find you, man?
You can find me on Instagram at Rye Talks About, RYTALKS, and then About, or on Letterboxd, where I am much more active at 182nd, O-N-E-82-N-D. I post all my reviews, I got lists, I got all those things.
Well, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02, so if I'm on the platform, that's my name, Twitter, or I guess it's ex-Twitter now, Letterboxd, all those places you can find me. Of course, here on the network, you'll find me with a lot of great Star Trek talk with Chris Jones as we talk about all of the different shows and their anniversaries. And so check all that out. And then over on the Nerd Party Network, you can find me on Outpost, a completed show talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, and then on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills as we talk about Star Wars each and every week. But thank you so much for joining us, and fist my bum.